November presidential election to provide services to the controversial NEOM megacity project that is planned to be constructed in Tabuk region of northwestern Saudi Arabia on the Red Sea in an area nearly the size of Belgium. The Israeli regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman reportedly held a secret meeting in NEOM City in late November last year. Edelman Communications firm was also hired by state-owned Saudi Basic Industries in early 2020 to provide strategic communications in a $5.6 million contract. Additionally, the Riyadh regime struck deals with companies seen as close to the Republican Party. Just before the presidential vote in November, the Saudi embassy in Washington hired Off-Hill Strategies, a firm run by a couple with a long history in conservative politics, for $75,000 to lobby for the Saudis through to January 2021. Ben Freeman of the Center of International Policy's Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative, which seeks to promote transparency and accountability in global relations, said the Saudis need to maintain their influence within the Republican Party post-Donald Trump in hope that the Republican Senate can help block any bills that might hurt them, like prohibitions on arms sales or withdrawing their occupation forces from neighboring Yemen. He added, there was this public perception that the Saudi lobby went into hiding following Jamal Khashoggi's murder. Ben Freeman added, but that's not true at all. What we saw is that actually they doubled down, giving money to think tanks and US universities to help launder their reputation. Ben Freeman noted that the Saudi kingdom hired the multinational firm Gorvis to a $10 million contract just 3 months after Jamal Khashoggi's death in 2018. In a bid to improve its image and reputation. Citing the failure of the Saudi crown prince and de facto ruler of the country, who has presented himself as a reformer to Western governments, Andrea Prasso, the deputy Washington director at Human Rights Watch, said Riyadh used lobbyists to whitewash its image in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden has vowed to be tougher on Saudi Arabia than former President Donald Trump, who bragged about protecting Mohammed bin Salman in the aftermath of the Jamal Khashoggi murder. Several intelligence agencies, including the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, have reportedly concluded that Mohammed bin Salman personally ordered Jamal Khashoggi's killing. Riyadh has denied the accusations. Saudi Arabia's human rights record has come under intense scrutiny following the murder of the Saudi dissident and famous journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Separately, amid a brutal crackdown led by the Saudi Crown Prince against pro-democracy activists, Muslim preachers and intellectuals in the Saudi kingdom, a Swiss-based human rights organization has called upon the United Nations to intervene and secure the release of distinguished dissidents in Saudi Arabia, including the cleric Sheikh Salman Al-Uda. Al-Karama asked the Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities to pursue the case of Sheikh Salman Al-Uda and urged independent experts to visit the imprisoned 64-year-old clergyman to examine him and report on his medical condition and needs. The cleric's son, Abdullah, wrote in a post published on his official Twitter page recently, the human rights organization called on the United Nations body to intervene and urge Saudi authorities to release the prominent scholar, Dr. Salman Al-Uda, who was arbitrarily detained, and stop the reprisals against his family members. The Arabic language Saudi newspaper Okaz reported on 4th of September 2018 that the Saudi public prosecutors had leveled 37 counts against Sheikh Salman Al Ouda and even demanded his execution. Saudi authorities detained a prominent Muslim scholar, Sheikh Salman Al Ouda, on 7th of September 2018 and have been holding him in solitary confinement without charge and without trial ever since. Saudi officials have also imposed a travel ban on members of his family. A family member told Human Rights Watch that the distinguished cleric was being held over his refusal to comply with an order by Saudi authorities to tweet a specific text to support the Saudi-led blockade of Qatar. The US-based human rights group Human Rights Watch said in a statement, Al Ouda instead posted a tweet saying, "May God harmonize between their hearts for the good of their people," an apparent call for reconciliation between Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Earlier this month, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Egypt signed a declaration on the eve of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, PGCC, Leaders Summit in the ancient desert city of Al Ula to ease a rift between Saudi Arabia and Qatar, signalling the end of a three and a half years of embargo of energy-rich Persian Gulf country. In June 2017, the four countries, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Egypt, accused Qatar, among other things, of supporting terrorism and having close ties to the Islamic Republic of Iran, and severed economic and diplomatic ties with Qatar. A blockade was also imposed by the four countries on Qatar by land, sea and air. Qatar has repeatedly denied the claims and said there was no justification for severing of relations. Also, a court in Saudi Arabia has sentenced a Shia Muslim eulogist to 9 months imprisonment as the Riyadh regime continues its heavy-handed crackdown on members of the Shiite religious community in the kingdom. The London-based and Arabic-language Nabah television network reported that a court of law in the city of Dammam, located about 400 kilometers east of Saudi Arabia's capital city of Riyadh, passed the ruling on Mohammad Boujabara, a Shia Muslim eulogist, for practicing religious rites. The same court also imposed 4-month prison sentence against 5 other defendants. On 4th of October 2020, the Saudi regime forces arrested Mohammad Boujabara and 8 other Saudi citizens in the Al-Asfar neighborhood of the Shiite populated region of Al-Ahsar in Saudi Arabia's eastern province as they were commemorating Arba'een, the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the third infallible successor to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Meanwhile, the European Saudi Organization for Human Rights has denounced the prison sentence handed down to Saudi Shia Muslim eulogist and his associates, voicing concerns about the dire situation of religious freedom in Saudi Arabia and spread of extremism in the country. The European Saudi Organization for Human Rights slammed the arbitrary arrest of Mohammad Boujabara and said the imprisonment and charges of exercising religious rights violates international law. Saudi Arabia has stepped up politically motivated arrests, prosecutions and convictions of peaceful dissident writers and human rights campaigners, in particular in Saudi Arabia's eastern province. The province has been the scene of peaceful demonstrations since February of 2011. Protesters have been demanding reform in Saudi Arabia, freedom of expression, the release of political prisoners in the country, and an end to economic and religious discrimination against the oil-rich region. The protests have been met with a heavy-handed crackdown by the Saudi authorities. In January of 2016, Saudi authorities executed the prominent Shia cleric, Sheikh Namb Bagher al-Namb, who was an outspoken critic of the Riyadh regime. Sheikh Namb Bagher al-Namb had been arrested in Qatif, also in eastern province of Saudi Arabia, in 2012.
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam my deen. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamun alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon all our brothers and sisters. You're listening to the Youth Station only on IRIB English Radio. So our topic for today is democratic dealing with the youth. I'm Hasnain and...
Salamun alaykum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, other life forms. He is Hasnain, I am Zainab, this is the show. Thank you for being with us. So, democracy toward youth.
You know, I guess it's dealing, how we deal with the youth. So, like, what parents need to do, like, what they don't need to do.
So, I'm thinking maybe democracy as opposed to dictatorship.
Yeah.
Right? Because a lot of parents, unfortunately, feel they have this dogma that says, my house, my rules.
Mm-hmm.
Though I understand and respect that, you have to understand that your children aren't your tenants. They're not like your slaves.
Yeah.
Exactly. They're not like people who are living in your house for a while and then they're going to move out. That is their house too. It's their home.
Yeah,
it's
they're your children. You don't need to take them for granted.
Yeah. It's where they belong. They belong to you. And not belong to you as if they're a possession, but they belong to you as if they rely on you, and not just on you putting a roof over their heads, but you supporting them, encouraging them, loving them unconditionally, telling them everything's going to be okay, and that no matter what happens, they're going to have their homes to return to. But do you think that this democracy toward the youth is something that should only be... Does it suffice for only the parents to have it with their kids, or is it the society's job as well?
It's of course the society's job as well.
How so?
You know, society is, you know, made up with the parents and the youth. So basically, even the society gets involved into this. So we need to, first of all, we need to look that, you know, parents have rights over children, and as well, children have rights over their parents.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, so, like, Sister Zainab, like, what do you suggest us to do?
For the youth?
Yeah.
I think it's simple. I mean, it's simple, but it's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
By simple, it mean, I mean it's not complicated, really. Mm-hmm. There's a hadith from, whether it's Rasulullah or Amir al-Mu'mineen, alayhi as-salam, I'm not sure, but not that it makes any difference, that the... His Eminence says, basically, you divide child upbringing into three levels. Each specified to a set of 7 years. Uh-huh. So first 7 years, second 7 years, third 7 years. You do whatever you can in this span of 21 years. Mm-hmm. And then His Eminence says, when they reach their, when they finish their third 7 years, you leave them.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, it doesn't mean that you abandon them. As in, you mean whatever you tell them from that point onward doesn't match, that doesn't have much of an effect on them anymore.
Yeah.
Because they've already established their personalities and they're set in their ways.
Yeah.
So the first 7 years, now I'm not trying to show that, turn this show into some sort of, you know, child upbringing 101, family psychology here in Ireland. No, this is not it. I'm just talking about, like, my understanding. I don't have kids.
Mm-hmm.
But from the teachings of Islam, they tell us the first 7 years, you should let your child do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you should, by doing whatever they want, it doesn't mean that, yeah, let them have chocolate-covered pancakes for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Uh-huh.
But allow them to experiment, allow them to experience, allow them to move and navigate within the safety of their home, under your supervision, in order to discover themselves in the world.
So we just don't need to, you know, put them inside the four walls.
Yes. Mm. Confine them to do that. You know some parents, how they are, like they have toddlers and they're like, no, don't touch this. No, don't go on the couch. No, don't write on the wall. No, don't put, don't, like they don't even let their toddlers eat themselves because they're like, no, you're going to get your clothes dirty.
Okay, so where does the problem lie exactly? You know, it's like, is it a problem that parents, you know, control their kids?
Where does it come from? I think it's from the parents' anxiety themselves, and they give their children anxiety.
Yeah, but of course, even parents, they need to control their children. You know, but
there's,
I guess it's about,
I,
you know, over-controlling things.
I think there's a difference between controlling and training.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You train your children. You're not supposed to control them.
Mm-hmm.
Even the prophets, when they came, none of them, Allah literally said in the Quran, you're not responsible for the deeds and action of these people. You're not you're not their wakil.
Yeah.
Right? You're not their...
They're responsible themselves.
Yeah, they're responsible themselves. You're just here to be a mundir and a mubashir. You're here to warn and give good tidings.
Yeah.
You're supposed to train them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they choose whether or not they want to put those trainings into practice.
Yeah.
I think it's the same for kids.
Yeah.
And when we say democracy towards our youth, I feel like that's what we should be aiming for, to train our children. Where do you think a parent's training toward their kids fails?
Timing?
Uh-huh.
I feel it's the timing. You know, they're just too late in training them. They should have, you know, upbringing. I guess, you know, the problem lies in the upbringing.
Mm.
You know, they should have trained them at the right time.
Mm.
And after that, you know, you see people, you know, they go to the scholars. They say, sir, our child, you know, he's not, you know,
praying,
he's not praying,
fasting.
You know, be it anything, like, he's away from Islam. What shall I do now? Like, you know, this is not the right time. You should have trained this,
late.
You know, when he was a toddler, when he was a child.
Actually, even before that, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam says, train your children from the time they are in the wombs of their mother.
Mm-hmm.
And the Sahaba are like, but how? Their little fetuses,
the action of the parents,
the food you feed them, the food
halal
the mother
food.
Eats exactly.
Yeah.
Halal food is so important. One of it's one of the pivotal, most significant training tools a parent can provide for their children.
Yeah.
To an extent where if the child's belly is filled with haram food, they will end up standing against the imam of their time and slaughtering him.
Yeah.
Like the enemies of Allah Abdin.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Can you think of any instances where parents, like from your friends, family, people close to you, acquaintances, where parents were dictators toward their children and how it led to devastating results?
I think that had few friends that, you know, the parents, you know, they used to completely control them. You know, they were not even allowed to go out with their friends. They were not even allowed to hang out with their friends. It's like whenever we used to call them, they're like, oh, my dad wouldn't agree. So, you know, I guess there's, you know, this over controlling. You know, there's no problem just to, you know, chill out with your friends. You know, you should at least allow that. So, you know, the devastating thing over here, you know, he's losing his, you know, his teenage. You know, he's just in the house. He cannot go out. He cannot discover new things. There lies a problem.
And what were the results? Do you know those people still? Do you feel like it had damaging results in their life?
Or when they became adults? The result was, you know, not as damaging as we think. But it was just, it was a loss to them.
And, you know, when you restrict your children so much, you're basically implying to them that I don't trust you.
You know, what I think is the restrictions should only be, you know, until the limit of Islamic boundaries. You should restrict them, you know, in this scenario. Like, anything related to Islam, like halal, haram, makruh, you shouldn't allow them to do haram stuff or any makruh or haram act. You know, these should be the restrictions.
Exactly. So within the boundaries of Islam, don't overdo it. Because it will drive the child crazy. And when you restrict them enough, you are implying to them that I don't trust you. When you tell them every time they want to go out with their friends, you say no, it means I don't trust your where you're going to go. I don't trust what you're going to do with your friends. I don't respect you enough as a human being. That's what the child will subconsciously understand and pick up, and that will, I think.
So here, the duty of parents is, you know, they should get to know their child. You know, when he grows up, he's a teenager. So, you know, rather than being a father or a mother, they should be their friend. You know, they should get to know them. Like, even if he wants to go out with his friends, they should know who his friends are.
Exactly.
You know, are they good people? Is he having a good company? Like, they should, he should know about the child itself and even his friends. So then you can take a decision, like, you want to send with them or not.
For sure, absolutely. Something else that I feel parents do...
Okay, so in this topic, so there's another question when we're talking about the parents and the children. So here, generally we get to see that these are two different generations. They're from different times. You know, when these parents, they themselves were teenagers, they had a different time. So, you know, they're of different times. You know, sometimes we even see that not just parents, even grandparents, you know, they control their kids, their grandchildren. That's a third generation.
Yeah.
So there's a lot, you know, time difference. There's an age gap.
Yes.
So, how does it impact, you know, on this?
Definitely an issue. I feel it's definitely an issue because each generation has its own requirements, has its own its own conditions, has its own history, politics, agendas, you know, has its own pop culture that generation understands, and it doesn't necessarily apply to the future generation.
Yeah, so what I guess is dictatorship comes in, like when parents saying that our children should live the way how we live.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
That we might say it might be dictatorship.
Yeah, it's definitely a form of dictatorship to force any human being to live the way you do, because you might want what's best for your kids, but you must understand that what's best for you isn't necessarily what's best for them. They are totally different human beings with different personalities to an extent. In a different society that has different requirements. And the best you can do for them is to train them in accordance with their needs and the needs of the society. You know, you can't apply the rules that you grew up with to your children.
Exactly.
Because it's
they're
expired.
They're born in a different time.
Exactly. It's expired. Those rules, and for that time, maybe it worked, maybe it didn't work, but whatever it is, it's done. You move on. You create a new set of rules that you feel will benefit your child the most according to the journey they're supposed to take in life.
So, dear listeners, thank you so much for staying with us. And Sister Zainab, thank you so much. So until next time, fi amanallah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator. My Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver. My defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance. When I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shirazada. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at a question that is very important, and that is the question of why is it that God has the sole right to legislate and to formulate laws? Why is it not permissible for human beings to formulate laws and legislate on their own?
This is a not only a theological problem, it's also a problem related to political science, Islamic political science, and it's very important. We can explain the answer to this question in the following way, that God's lordship, or lordship in general, can be divided into two distinct categories. There's a cosmological lordship, and there's a legislative lordship over the affairs of human beings, which comes in the form of the regulation of laws, which is the subject of discussion here. We've already talked about, and this is something that should be established in its own place, that God is the creator of the world, the sole creator of the world, therefore he owns the world cosmologically, and he regulates the world, therefore he has authority over them, and therefore he rules them. Now, the legislation of laws is a type of regulation. It's a regulation of human beings, and it is the regulation of human society. By the formulation of laws, right, the person who formulates the laws, in this way he regulates society. He oversees their affairs, he manages them, he manages society. At the same time, it is a type of governance over people. It is a type of authority over their affairs, over their lives, over their wealth. Right. So legislation is a type of regulation of human beings. At the same time, it's an authority and rule over human beings. So we know that God, being the creator of the universe, he is the sole regulator and owner of the universe, and therefore he's the sole ruler of the universe. And consequently, we can come to the conclusion that he is the sole being and only being who has the right to legislate. A question may pop up here, and that is this. What about the jurisprudence and the mujtahideen, right? The mujtahids, don't they formulate laws? You're saying, on one hand, we say that God is the sole being who has the right to formulate laws and legislate. At the same time, there are also fuqaha and mujtahideen, jurisprudence, who legislate laws. Isn't this a contradiction? And God has given them the authority to legislate laws. How do we resolve this contradiction? The answer to this question is that no, these mujtahids and these jurisprudents are experts in their field, and their responsibility is not to legislate laws. Rather, the laws that God has legislated and formulated, these experts in this field come and try to discover what these laws are. They explain them, they discover them, they derive them from their sources, which are manifested in the form of the Quran and the Hadiths, and then they present them to the human beings, to the people and the human beings, so that they can practice them. Right. So these jurisprudents are not legislators per se. Rather, they don't have the authority to legislate laws on their own. Rather, their function and the responsibility is to disclose and to discover the laws which God has legislated. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the problem of God's right to legislate, as well as the function of jurisprudence within the parameters of God's right to legislate, and his being the sole legislator. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on RIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Coronavirus pandemic has become an endless nightmare for much of the world. Despite the development and distribution of a range of new vaccines, many countries are still struggling to battle the deadly waves of the highly transmissible disease. As the world steps up efforts to contain the deadly virus, new variants are rapidly replacing older versions, making the situation even more frightening. Many thousands of people lose their lives every day worldwide, despite restrictive measures that have paralyzed economies. The pandemic could get much worse before it gets better. The world is undoubtedly eager to find out how the whole thing began so that future risks can be minimized. The origin of COVID-19 has been a major bone of contention, especially between the world's worst coronavirus-hit country, the United States, and China, where the deadly virus was first detected in December 2019. The two sides have exchanged barbs over the origin of the crisis. Now all eyes are focused on a fact-finding mission on the origins of the pandemic. A team of scientists from the World Health Organization is right now in the Chinese city of Wuhan trying to find out the origins of the outbreak. The WHO says its fact-finding mission in Wuhan is purely scientific, but the probe is facing a political minefield. The World Health Organization team will carry out on-the-ground investigations into the source of the new coronavirus. The WHO scientists will visit different places in Wuhan and talk to people and officials. The WHO says all hypotheses are on the table during the probe. The WHO team is expected to inspect a seafood market in Wuhan, which was linked to many of the first COVID-19 cases in December 2019. The scientists will also visit hospitals that treat coronavirus patients in the city. But how much will the team of investigators be able to uncover? The WHO experts face a tough task as the city has been repeatedly disinfected. The investigation is ongoing in Wuhan, but there have been cautions against expecting any breakthroughs soon. It could take years before any firm conclusions can be reached. What's making the WHO mission even tougher is the fact that it has been highly politicized. Several countries, particularly the United States, accuse the Chinese government of hiding the outbreak's severity during its early stages. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump kept criticizing China for alleged failures in containing the outbreak and refusing to tell the truth. The WHO itself was branded by Trump as a, quote, puppet of China. The Chinese government has dismissed Western allegations, saying the virus might have begun outside of China. Trump is now gone, but the White House is keeping up pressure on Beijing. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki expressed concern this week about what she called misinformation coming out of China. Beijing has warned against any negative speculation and politicized interpretation of the fact-finding mission. Will the WHO scientists be able to carry out their investigation properly despite all the political pressure?
Obviously, the scientific medical investigation may help for future prevention or development of science in terms of understanding how viruses change and how the pandemic started and how the new virus originated. Obviously, among scientists, or at least the majority of scientists, believe what happened is a natural mutation of the virus.
Observers believe that the scientists should be allowed to complete their work independently because the results could prove vital for the future of mankind.
Was planned by the Dutch government as a system to prevent the rapid spread of the COVID-19 virus in the Netherlands has turned sour, as it seems that the curfew imposed has been met with staunch opposition, with four nights of rioting taking place across the country, causing shops to be looted, infrastructure to be damaged, and police having to react to contain the disturbance. With police facing rioters on the front line, water cannons, CS gas, and other forms of police force have had to be deployed, resulting in hundreds of arrests being made and fines allocated to those who break the curfew rules. Yet it seems after four nights of violence involving a crowd formed by a majority of youths, the police have managed to take hold of the situation as protests have died down as the consequences of the actions of the rioters are being met with a tough stance by the police and the government. In fact, the reaction by the Dutch government is one of anger, as it claims that all damage will be paid for by those responsible, A tough task to apply, but something that the government of Mark Rutte is keen to go through with, as echoed by the Dutch finance minister, who has labelled the rioters as scum. Many of the protests and rioters are complaining about the measures being taken by the Dutch government when it comes to containing and dealing with the virus, claiming a curfew still does not eradicate the virus. But many in the Netherlands do not agree with the protests, stating that only a small minority of people are causing so much trouble.
Well, we're very sorry about it. It's just really unfortunate, actually. I have a feeling that most of these people, not all of them, some are genuine protesters against Corona rules, right? But most of them are just people who usually attend football matches and just are looking for rioting, etc. And that's really unfortunate. I mean, that's just not what all of the Netherlands is. I mean, this is just like 0.1% of population, or maybe 0.01% of population. It's very unfortunate that it gets such a lot of international attention.
With a country very much like the rest of Europe, impatient to get the vaccines rolled out, hence allowing life to return to some kind of normality, it remains to be seen what will happen until then. However, deep in the mix of the protests, yet still visible enough to be seen, it seems that the protests and riots are a stage for another form of demonstration in the Netherlands, one that may yet again rise its ugly head in the near future. Many countries across the world have seen the effects of the pandemic affect their social well-being, causing many people to reach boiling point, as over 12 months of hardship has seen the world change the way it performs, even the most benign of duties. Yet worryingly, in the Netherlands, pockets of protests have included political groups, which most concerning of all, contain far-right movements, with evidence suggesting that the Dutch branch of the German-born Pegida ideology has been counted amongst the protesters. The Netherlands has a strong far-right influence in its political parties, and this has been reflected by some far-right politicians calling on the Dutch military to step in and protect the streets of the country against the rioters, something that suggests the current plan to control the situation by the police may just not be enough, in spite of a calmer last day or two. But the Netherlands, as we know, has a strong anti-immigrant and in particular anti-Muslim following, inspired by the likes of far-right leader Geert Wilders, who in his past rhetoric has made his feelings very clear about certain communities living in the country.
Look at the Islamization of our country. If a Dutch person driving in a car drives 5 miles too fast, he will be fined within a minute. Whereas the Moroccan scum in Holland, and once again, not all are scum, but there is a lot of Moroccan scum in Holland who makes the streets unsafe, mostly young people, and they are not taken seriously. We are making them and the people unsafe, and that should change.
With far-right groups such as Pediger now emerging in the shadows of the protests, could this openly public sentiment fall into the hands of far-right leaders, such as Geert Wilders, who may use the surge in feelings to fuel his campaign to bring the far-right up another notch on the political spectrum, especially as the Dutch are due to face an upcoming election following the resignation of current Prime Minister Mark Rutte following a welfare payment scandal. There's no doubt that far-right groups across Europe are still very much in place, and although the COVID-19 virus has played its part on diverting attention away from politics for now, could the example seen in the Dutch protests and riots be the catalyst for other far-right groups in Europe to jump on the bandwagon and politicise the virus to their own benefits?
January 26th is remembered by many Australians as a national day, with many celebrating the occasion with pop and show to mark the anniversary of the 1788 arrival of a group of British ships called the First Fleet at Port Jackson in New South Wales and the raising of the British flag at Sydney Cove by Arthur Phillip. The part of the celebrations was hoisting an Australian flag over Sydney's Opera House and displaying the word Austay on the sky over the Sydney Harbour. But the celebrations of the origins of a modern nation are a time of mourning for Indigenous Australians who have endured discriminations despite inhabiting the land for centuries. They view the arrival of British settlers 200 years ago as the beginning of pain and suffering. They even brand the Australia Day as Invasions Day. That's why thousands of people, mainly Indigenous, defied coronavirus restrictions on Tuesday and took to the streets in several cities to highlight their plight. Some protesters chanted a slogan such as sovereignty was never ceded and no justice, no peace, while others held up placards reading not a day to celebrate and Black Lives Matter.
It's very important because the issues that we're facing here in Australia are not going to go away overnight. So until we start getting justice and start seeing change in this country, we will not stop. This will continue. We no longer call it Australia Day, it's now Invasion Day. Always was and always will be Invasion Day.
But why do Indigenous Australians view this auspicious day as Invasion Day?
There's a much wider recognition these days of the 26th of January as an Invasion Day or a Survival Day, because at least for the last generation or so, younger people have learnt that the colonisation of this country was not simply a matter of settlement, it was a matter of brutal dispossession, it was a matter of genocide, it was a matter of trying to obliterate the culture of Indigenous people here. And at least for the last 30 or so years, there's been a recognition every year and some greater recognition in schools and universities of that sort of history. So there is now, as a result, this very strong tension between the ongoing celebration of colonisation called Australia Day and the recognition of survival or Invasion Day, which is an important educative influence over younger people in this country.
Australia Day, which was formally declared a national holiday only in 1994, has increasingly heightened heated debates in recent years. The occasion is staunchly defended by right-wing commentators and retains strong support from the country's conservative government. Prime Minister Scott Morrison believes history changed forever in 1788 and that there was no escaping or cancelling that fact. He says for the better and worse, it was the moment where the journey to modern Australia began. But federal opposition leader Anthony Albanese has a totally different reading of the whole historical journey. This is Australia Day, is the one Australians need to acknowledge that it has been a very difficult day for the First Nations people.
In the first instance, it's important for us to recognise our own history and the consequences of our own history and the fallout of that colonisation and dispossession and the way in which the non-Aboriginal communities benefited from that and still benefit from that and the ongoing enormous social advantage against Indigenous people in this country, which far outweighs that of any other community. So if we don't understand our own history, we can't have a resolution of contemporary problems. Secondly, because Australia is involved in a lot of adventures, a lot of neocolonial adventures in other countries, we can't recognise the problems of that and the problems of our own intervention in other countries unless we understand our own history and the colonisation of our own history.
Australia's Aboriginals currently represent around 3% of the country's population, but the most disadvantaged lot of the society. They are also said to be largely excluded in their limited capacity to participate in the decision-making or even control their own and mainstream social and cultural environment. From forcible suppression of children from their families to their being displaced from their land, limited education, and inadequate employment, discrimination has been widely reported by advocacy groups. But how has the Australian Indigenous population been marginalised even to the present day?
Well, there's been enormous disadvantage. It occurs across the board. For example, Aboriginal people in prison are something like 14 to 15 times overrepresented. In education, there's been enormous disadvantage. In health, there's terrible disadvantage. As I said, there's no other ethnic group or community that is nearly as disadvantaged as Aboriginal people, despite the fact that large amounts of money have been spent on particular programs, but they haven't achieved success because there's a very deep cultural alienation, for example, from the institutions and the educational institutions of Australia.
All in all, what needs to be done is for the Australian government to put an end to the misery of the Indigenous people and take steps to make it not look like they're from another planet.
It's very rare that a former leader publicly criticizes or provides advice to his or her successor, and is often something that protocol frowns upon when it's done. However, this has not stopped the former Labour Chancellor and Prime Minister Gordon Brown from doing so, leaving Boris Johnson red-faced in the process. So intense has the criticism been that Gordon Brown has stated that Britain is becoming a failed state, not only through the poor mishandling of various crises by the British government, but also because of the ever-widening and deepening divisions within the British socio-political system. It seems that Brown has placed the blame squarely at the feet of Boris Johnson, suggesting that the Prime Minister is so alienated from the reality in which British people are living that he has lost scope of how British feel on a variety of issues and everyday problems. One of the main reasons for the disparity is the divide between the Conservative Party and the people, a division that's traditionally seen different classes voting for different parties in the UK, with the working class commonly leaning towards Labour and the upper middle class swinging towards the Tories, hence leading to a lack of communication between the ruling party and the majority of people in Britain. One such example of just how divided the UK are as a population is the opinion on Brexit. With such a slim divide between those wishing to leave the EU and remain, the difference of opinion of people across the whole of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and the north of Ireland is already fractured, without raising the notion of nationalism and separatism into the equation. So when the element of nationalism is introduced into the argument, for example, in the case of Scotland, is former Prime Minister Gordon Brown right when he says that the UK is on the verge of becoming a failed state? And if so, just how serious is the problem?
It's obvious that the present system isn't working. When you have one of the constituent nations, Scotland and the other, completely at odds with the capital and the sort of the economic core of the country, then it obviously the system is not working. A political system is not good just to, hasn't just to represent a numerical majority, it has to represent all sectors of society and all regions of a country, and this current system is obviously failing to do so.
Back in 2014, the majority of Scots rejected the idea of having an independent Scotland, for the country was benefiting from EU budgets allocated to its agriculture, economy and education sectors. However, now that Britain has left the EU, Scots see themselves empty-handed and are highly considering rejoining the EU once again. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has repeatedly stated that she would push for a second referendum if her party wins a majority in May elections. Sturgeon has insisted on her country's political independence by stating that Westminster's consent to the move is not their priority, for it's for the people of Scotland to choose and not the lawmakers in Westminster. Latest polls shows that nearly half of the people in Scotland are now in favour of an independent country, a figure that's likely to increase even more as Scots see less benefits flow into their country, and Scottish nationalism is significantly on the rise, hence putting the Scottish people much closer to the option of voting for such a move.
Well, yes, because the last referendum they had was under completely different circumstances. Britain was part of the European Union. Scotland, the Scots were very happy Europeans, and they liked it that way. When Britain left the European Union, they were left, defenceless and without allies in the face of an overweening London capital. So, yeah, they're entitled to ask for it. Whether they should get it or not, is another story. Once the time comes, vote for independence.
Some of the problems that Britain is struggling with in its post-Brexit era and the widening political and social inequality have encouraged other countries within the UK to consider leaving, for they believe that they're better off on their own. Current polls indicate that over half the people of the north of Ireland welcome the idea of holding a referendum on a united Ireland. Also in Wales, people are starting to back the idea of holding a referendum on independence, spelling the inevitable breakup of the United Kingdom in the process. Can Boris Johnson's Conservative government, therefore, reunite a divided Britain? Or has the pendulum swung too far past the tipping point, taking Britain towards a collapsed failed state full of internal division? Allah, Allah,
Allah, این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah Allah.
This is part of a speech of Imam Khomeini, the founder of Islamic Revolution, on ethics and politics. All problems and differences of humanity will be resolved if the human being's selfishness and animal desires are purified, trained, and tamed. June 2, 1981. Those seeking to train and educate others in the world should themselves be purified and purged before they carry out their tasks. June 2, 1981.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We are with another episode of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the prophets of God. Imam Khomeini has said that the prophetic mission created a scientific Gnostic change in the world that converted the inspired Greek philosophies, which were formulated with all their past and present worth by the Greeks themselves, into an objective mysticism and a veritable intuitive perception for masters of divine insight. Now, this statement is a heavy statement which was given by Imam Khomeini. Obviously, we know that he was a philosopher and a mystic too. And this claim that he made, he is true in this claim, because it is the prophetic mission And it is the prophetic mission, it is the prophets who came, who told people that the one who has created you is Allah. There is something beyond you. The existence that you have, when you talk about this existence, even this existence is given you by a necessary being. Who is there? We all are the possible beings. All these things are discussed in the philosophy. We talked about the being, the possible being, or maybe the necessary being. These are all discussed in the philosophy. And it is the prophetic mission that has made a change into the insipid Greek philosophies, and which were formulated with all their past and present worth. And then it changed it into an objective mysticism and the veritable intuitive perception for masters of divine insight. If today in the philosophy, in the Islamic philosophy, we see that we talk about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the existence of God, the existence of human being, the things that are beyond the metaphor things, if we talk about them, it is because of the prophetic mission, inshallah.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Every night and every day, never forget to say La ilaha
IRIB English Radio.